Hi, this is Paul. Today we had a members-only question and answer in the membership section. The channel does have a membership section, and the basic membership is $3. And so if you're interested in seeing the whole question and answer, you can see this video. You can, for $3, you can get into the membership section. Joseph, the link's below in terms of how to do that. Joseph came back in after Joseph was in last week's big conversation too. Stirred up a lot of controversy about orthodoxy and basically made a map that showed just how few and far between orthodox churches really are for people. And then we talked about challenges. Now he is studying to be a deacon in the Orthodox Church. And so he's deeply invested. He's, you know, deeply orthodox, but he's provoking a lot of very good conversations about culture and orthodoxy. And that thread sort of continued to go through a number of the conversations in the question and answer. And so I decided to sort of take all of those bits and put them together. There's also a little piece from a Luke live stream about, let's say, the implicit knowledge that is built into our actions that we are not consciously aware of and how we discover that, either for better or for worse. And so I decided to put all of this together into one video. It was quite a wonderful, interesting series of conversations. And for me, just getting to articulate and bring to the surface some things about knowledge, tacit knowledge, explicit knowledge, and all those things. And we'll talk about orthodoxy, talk about Methodism, seeker services, all these different aspects of doing church, and the relationship between, let's say, churches with shallow traditions being something that can expand very quickly into the world, but then in time them needing to dig deeper into the roots of older traditions in order to really come to full flourishing and permanence. So that's really what all of these little elements of this video are about. So the last compilation video seemed to work well, so thought I'd try again. I just need a good title and a good thumbnail. All right, Joseph, you.
Oh boy, you really
started something last week, man.
Oh, I know. I made some people upset.
I'm sure you did.
I'm a troll. What can I say? I'm a professional troll. I've been doing this for a while. My question. I have a question that's not my question.
Okay.
Can I share my screen?
Yeah. Oh, I think so. Wait. How do I? I don't know. We can do that in Zoom. Boy, I don't know if we can do that here. Yeah.
That it says here. It wasn't a technicality question. It was just a permission.
Okay, it's like
I'm asking for a blessing.
Master question. There we go. Sorry. Can I share my screen? Yes, you can.
That'll be one of your three wishes.
It's like at the fantasy football draft. You had the first pick and you picked a kicker, huh?
So, yeah. Right.
All right. So
okay, here I'm going to share my screen here.
All right, there we go.
So I just a quick background. My education is in econometrics. I'm a regression analysis, data visualization kind of guy. I guess I probably have crossover with Sam. I don't know. He's smarter than me though.
Yeah, Sam's smarter than all of us, but
yeah, except he denies the Trinity, so that's not smart of him. No, I'm kidding. So what we're looking at here is a messy representation. I had to pull this all together because, you know, people come to Greek Fest and we give them a tour of our church and they love our church and they love the beauty of Orthodoxy. And they're like, yeah, you know, this is a beautiful church. It would be great if we could have something like this, you know, but I just can't trust organized religion. And we say to them, well, you know, Orthodoxy is a disorganized religion. So, you know, you'll be home here. So I had to put all this stuff together. There's no governing body that has ever had a view like this before, as far as I'm concerned. And I'm not trying to hype my work up, but it's just like, this is how down bad we are. So what we're looking at right here, if I can zoom in, whoa, not that far. Let's see how this works. So I live in Minnesota. And this is what you're looking at for Orthodox parishes in Minnesota. You have pretty slim pickings. These are zip codes. These are zip codes that
So either they're not showing density. They're just showing existence within a zip code.
In a given zip code. And for most of these zip codes, it's one church. 75% of these zip codes, it's one Orthodox church. Okay.
Wow.
And I live somewhere around over here. And so I can drive 80 miles to get to Rochester where I go to church, or I can, which is like an hour and 20 minutes, or I can drive an hour and get into the horrible traffic of the cities. So, and go to a church in one of the cities.
Yeah.
I know people here in Mankato, Minnesota. You got like a 2-hour trip to church. Okay. Yeah. Now, what about these poor souls over here in South Dakota, Western Minnesota, Northern Iowa? It's a barren wasteland. And if it's these zip codes, if they're orange, that means it's not classified as an urban environment. These are rural communities. They're
but those large also have an Orthodox church in them.
Yes. Yes. If the zip code, if there's any color, that means there's an Orthodox church in this given zip code. If it's blue, that means it's classified as a metro, statistical metro area. So basically what we're dealing with is 8%, 8.5% of all Americans live in a zip code with an Orthodox church.
Wow.
I think you'd probably have like something like 90% for like ELCA Lutherans. Yeah. Okay. Probably there's probably, you know, so we got a big problem here. And I believe, and I mean, I'm an Orthodox. I'm in my final year of the Holy Cross Diaconate program. Like, I'm just not some schmuck who's coming on here and, you know, speaking bad about Orthodoxy because I'm resentful or something. I'm just a realistic guy, and I have a family. And
probably low in agreeableness.
Yeah. Well, you know, I come from a long line of salesmen. So, but basically, what I'm just trying to get at here, Paul, is what is the future for somebody who Grim Grizz is going to get mad at me because this might be a long question here. So I'm not trying to take up too much time here, but you have somebody who comes at Orthodoxy as a propositional confessional statement. I believe Orthodoxy is the fullest expression of the Christian faith. I believe that, you know, the theology, the liturgical life, the spiritual life of Orthodoxy excels more than any other Christian tradition, which I believe, and I'm not saying that to be mean. I honestly believe that from what
I'm not,
I've been,
I'm not like, offended.
No. But
someone subs and says my baby is the most beautiful baby in the world.
But here's the thing, Paul. A thousand fall by the left and 10,000 by the right hand. You know, as the Psalms say. You know, there's 10,000. You know, the temptation of my Orthodoxy. You know, you Orthodoxy or death, man. You can't convince me of anything else, and you're inferior because you're not Orthodox. But then also there's the temptation of the left and the temptation of the right hand's far, well, it's mirrored here, but the temptation of the right is far more dangerous than the left. And I'm talking about spiritually here, not political.
Right.
And the temptation of the left hand is, you know, it doesn't matter. Dogma, confessions, who cares? You know, let's just be, you know, unity over truth. I don't know. There's temptations. Let's just say there's temptations on both sides here. And where I'm going with this is, it's like you by accepting the confession of faith of Orthodoxy and the there's more to it than just that. There's the practice of Orthodoxy. There's the spiritual ethos of Orthodoxy. There's a lot more than just a confession. And we have people here in, let's say, we have people here in Mankato, Minnesota, who go to a beautiful Catholic church, a beautiful ELCA church, a beautiful Anglican church, whatever church. And beautiful, not just in architecture, but, you know, in terms of they have a community here. They know people here. They can love people here. And you have this little Joe Schmo here who is going to his LCMC Lutheran church, and he decides, wow, I'm convinced that orthodoxy is the fullest extent of the Christian faith. And now I've accepted this confessional statement. I've accepted this propositional statement. And now I've isolated myself from any, you know, communal participatoriness or, you know, what is the future? My question, Paul, is what is the future here? Because I don't see there being an aggressive Baron Vladimir von Harkonnen expansionist policy here of we're gonna get an Orthodox church in every single flipping zip code by 2025 or something like that. You know, we're not gonna see anything like that. So what is the answer for the guy in Mankato, Minnesota? What's the future here? What do you see, Paul?
Well, obviously, church planting needs to be a priority for the Orthodox Church, but it's a funny tradition. So my friend Kevin Adams up in Granite Springs, he became good friends with Father Chris, the Greek Orthodox priest right down the road, became very good friends. And of course, my friend Kevin Adams came in, he used to mow Bill Hybels' mother's lawn, and came in, and you know, the Christian Reformed Church, we're doing church planting. We planted, you know, a number of churches here in the Sacramento area, and said, talk to Father Chris, well, what's your strategy for church planting? He says, well, we're evangelism. Well, we're not ready to do evangelism because we don't have our cathedral or our monastery yet. So
And that's not coming anytime soon. I mean, people talk about monasteries. Sorry, this is something I wanted to address, Paul, from the previous live stream. People were saying I don't like monasteries or something because I was flustered. And it's like, you guys don't understand that what we have in the monastery situation was the result of a very, very abnormal thing with what happened with Elder Ephraim, who I view as a holy man. And you know, you don't just get something like what the monastery explosion that is still predominantly all Greek. You know, you go to these monasteries, it's all Greek, baby. And funny enough, the monastery, one of the largest women's monastery in Kenosha, Wisconsin, over half of the women there are like born Lutheran women, and they're just like living like Greeks. And I'm sorry, but that's not scalable. It's one of my favorite places in the world. It's not scalable. I'm sorry, I'm derailing your I'm hijacking things here, Paul.
No, it's great. Churches follow culture. I mean, that's the short answer. If you look, you could do a study of Christian Reformed churches, and what you will find is that Christian Reformed churches follow patterns of Dutch immigration.
Yep.
And then what happened then?
Why do you think Chicago's like this?
Yeah, exactly. Greeks. Exactly. And there's a few there in Western Michigan, up there by Grand Rapids, which is one of the heaviest, most heavily churched places in the country.
Yeah.
Now, if you were to do Christian Reformed churches in that area that you're showing, I mean, they would be all over the place.
Yeah.
Because again, a pattern of Dutch immigration. So your Greek churches are following Greek immigration. Mm-hmm. Your churches, your Russian and Ukrainians, they're following those immigrant groups. And then they will have critical mass to build the institutions. What's happening now in the Christian Reformed church is that, again, the Christian Reformed Church has been in a process of assimilation into, out of their immigrant roots, into general ethnicity in the country. And so what that means is you're going to be transitioning from an ethno church to a credo church. And then you have the question of, well, does your particular credo sort of have enough that is compelling to the religious marketplace, to use a terribly crass term, which I don't particularly like, to actually gain traction and to grow? And, you know, the churches, you know, get back to sort of Jeremy. I mean, some of the fastest growing churches in America have tended to be Christian offspring that were Americans, such as Mormons and Jehovah's Witnesses. They are deeply American in terms of their orientation. And so there's a cultural element to that. So, you know, all of these immigrant churches, and pretty much almost all churches in America are from immigration because of how America was been populated by the world, have this challenge to meet. And what has tended to happen in American life is that size matters. And so part of the reason Roman Catholics have been, one might count, successful, at least in putting Roman Catholic churches all over America,
yeah,
as a brand, it's because they were in so many different ethnic groups. And then,
yes, right,
even though someone knows, well, that's an Irish Catholic or a Polish, yeah, Catholic or an Italian Catholic, maybe I'll still go there because at, yeah, least it's Catholic. And so Orthodoxy, let's say,
we get that here, by the way. Sorry. Yeah. We have Ukrainians, Serbs. Yep. We're a very diverse crowd here because we're the only Orthodox church in, 100 miles.
Yeah. And the patterns are going to follow geopolitical patterns. Now, the Greeks had a leg up because of the history of Greece and their struggle, yeah,
right,
for independence,
right,
from the collapsing Ottoman, yep, Empire. And so then Greeks had a chance to come over, and Armenians had a chance to come over because of those tragedies. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, with the collapse of the communist bloc, now suddenly Russians and Ukrainians and Romanians and Bulgarians and, all of these groups can then come. So even though we are very much having a conversation sort of up here, because Christianity itself has that dynamic, and then someone will say, well, I'd really love to go to an Orthodox church, but there's a Roman Catholic church down, yep, the road.
Right.
So then, right, there are similarities with the Catholics, as opposed to, let's say, the Protestants, where if you come in with a lot of iconography, some of the Protestants are going to look weird at you. Never mind the fact that the Protestants will come in, with their own kinds of iconography that aren't really considered iconic. I mean, all of this, mm-hmm, is just the way it goes. And so, Orthodoxy as a brand in a very, people are, I try to remind people regularly that on one hand, looking through the internet and YouTube, they might say, wow, stock is rising for the Orthodox. Look at all these people becoming Orthodox. And it's true.
It's, hey, look at real estate in 2006.
Right. But, yeah, if you, and a really fun channel is Ready to Harvest, yeah, that channel, right, where he goes through denominations.
Yes. He's a Minnesota guy too.
Yeah. He says, well, overall Orthodoxy is numerically actually declining.
Yes. Yeah.
And it's like,
yes,
well, why would that be? Well, because the bulk of people coming, yeah, in are immigrants and they're acclimating, yeah, to America and they're becoming, going through all these changes. So pictures are enormously challenging. So
I don't care that there's six new, potentially autistic male converts at some Antiochian parish in Kansas. I care how many churches are being built, how many, new monastics have there been, how many new monasteries, how many new bishops, how many new saints, those five metrics are what determines Orthodoxy in America, yeah, not,
Yeah.
And a lot of these converts are having massive attrition, massive.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because they approach it with confession of belief. I accept that. I'm good to go. Oh, wait, there's all this praxis and, spiritual life to live. It's like,
yeah,
So
it's a steep slope.
Yeah. Yes.
Religion.
Yes.
Now, steep slope has an advantage because people who can handle the steep slope, they get very strong.
Yeah.
And there's power in that. And there's power, yeah, that can be leveraged in terms of multiplication. It's impressive. But numerically, it's challenging because many people can't take the steep slope. And, yes, so they
and take away Christendom. Take away Christendom.
Yeah.
With the steep slope religion. What emperor is going to sponsor 50 new churches in Iowa?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's, yeah, like, I feel, and this is just you can kick me off now because I'm not even asking a question, but I feel like the Orthodoxies, we've been struggling to figure out what the heck do we do without an emperor since the fall of Constantinople, and Russia, kind of distracted us from that question. But now it's like, okay, are we going to go build communes? Do we just want the Russian world to take over? Or are we just going to try to go back to like 200s Christianity?
Yeah.
You know,
and the truth is, every segment of Christianity in the church has analogous challenges. The Christian Reformed Church has to ask, how do we multiply without immigration? Now, yeah. That's an old question because immigration stopped in the 1950s, really.
And how many Christians are in Europe, you know, comparatively to...
Exactly. You know. So then it was, well, how can we reach Americans? So then Christian Reformed Church starts playing around with seeker methodology and all these other methodologies to reach Americans. But then the question is, well, how is that church there in Granite Springs in Rockland, California, is that Christian Reformed? And that leads to the big conversation that's beneath the whole same-sex marriage. What does it mean to be Christian Reformed? Which is a question that the denomination has been struggling with since Andy Kivenhoven said it's time to burn the wooden shoes. And I think it's that reason why I do these wonky videos on, you know, the angst of the Christian Reformed Church. And I get all these comments of, I've never seen a Christian Reformed Church and you're the only Christian Reformed Church person I know, but boy, these videos seem just like what's going on in my church.
Yeah, because once you get into it, once you get your feet wet, you realize what's, you know, everything's just holding on by threads, you know?
Yeah, it's true. Well, thank you, Joseph.
Yeah, all right, kick me off.
All right, Paul. See you later.
So you were talking about like what it's like to try to found a new school, right? And sometimes I have fantasies of founding a new school. But in fact, I work at a Catholic school in my town that's, you know, a pretty normal school, right? It's been around for a really long time. It has like the normal school structure that you would expect. And it interacts with the state authorities and the way that schools generally do, right? All that kind of stuff. And I do find that there's some value to just being able to join an institution that already has all that stuff in place, right? And then just seeing if within your classroom you can do a really good job at whatever specific thing it is that you're trying to do, right? There is an advantage to doing that rather than trying to found a new idealistic project.
Because it's hard to think of all the skills and abilities and details that you lack or won't have thought of that are already embodied in these institutions that have been around for a while, even if they're not great.
And if you want to think of those things, try to start a school because they will become apparent to you.
And you will pay in ways you cannot imagine for a very long time.
Yep. It's hard. Yeah, reform is always better.
I want to put a lighter note too. There's also incredible support and incredible success that can come, but not without paying for it, and definitely not as a lone ranger. You need a supportive team around you, or you just can't do it.
Yeah, I'm going to try to set this up because it really revolves around like the everyone that's just kind of been talking with the ideas, but the one that Jacob brought in about the ideas of what are we going to do, quote unquote, the Orthodox Church with growth, but really
Joseph,
that really what's implicit there is because you brought in the Reformed Church as well. Like what are we? What are you trying to propagate? Are we trying to propagate a culture or a church? And what I found working in a very low Protestant church was when the culture actually started to emerge, which this also goes into the TLC conversation that Luke brought in, that when the culture starts to emerge, you can kind of see this thing that you could replicate.
Mm.
And the culture of Orthodoxy is so complex because it's not just tied to really fast moving, easy to load like things.
Yeah.
That trying to do that is extremely difficult. And part of me wonders, and I would be interested in your thoughts on this, if the conversation could happen between, and maybe it is at higher levels, the success of the American megachurch, though in some ways waning as we find ourselves, it was a true entrepreneurial success.
Yeah.
That there is actually a lot of wisdom that you could share across worlds to help see things grow. if we could get to that more maybe universal understanding better our universal language and our universal history as a church.
Yeah.
And I think some of the, I don't know, some of what we do here is trying to maybe tap into that. So that's my question, if that's a question.
Well, so think about a bunch of trade-off relationships. You know, when you first started that, I thought about the fact that it's probably really difficult to plant an Orthodox church among people for whom orthodoxy is strange. Going back to what I talked about with Luke, even a very learned Orthodox priest who is very well prepared in terms of the liturgy and all of those elements, that the Orthodox Church emphasizes initiation. Okay, so there's initiation, and by virtue of this dynamic where there's more knowledge compressed in action than there is in language, descriptive language, propositional language, scaling that initiation is going to be really, really difficult. And that's Joseph's main point. Joseph's main point is that the bottleneck for deploying orthodoxy in the new world is, as it almost always is, leadership development, leadership multiplication. Because the one thing that I saw in the church planting seeker movement was the one thing you really need to plant a church is a leader. You can do it without a building. You can do it without a congregation. You can do it without almost everything, but you need a leader. And so you have to prepare those leaders. Now, new things by that analysis, new things are easier to multiply quickly. And so I think that's part of the reason that we saw the seeker movement multiply quickly. It had to draw from a shallower thing.
Practice. Yeah.
Yeah. And so you can multiply that quickly. Now, what tended to happen in the church planting wave that I saw in the 90s and aughts was the leaders went out and planted. But after they planted, they very quickly became aware of the insufficiencies that they had. And so one of the things that you saw, even from what we called the lottery winners, which were the pastors that went out and got over 200 in 2 years, and many of them got over 1,000 within 3 or 4 years, was you begin to find a lot of these guys getting re-education, getting into you know, like the Renovare movement, which was Christian spiritual practices, Dallas Willard. You look at John Mark Comer, for example, and that's just a classic example of that. Where, and then, you know, even my friend Kevin Adams, who goes out to Granite Springs and is, in terms of CRC terms, is a remarkably successful church planter, because very few Christian Reformed churches actually flourish outside of places of Dutch immigration. And he manages to go to a place without any Dutchmen and gets a church up over 200 within 2 years. Now, his church didn't break 1,000, but he got up over 200 in 2 years. And there's just a handful of CRC ministers that managed to do that in an area where there wasn't 2,000 existent Christian Reformed Church members plus a Christian school. I have a friend who did all these demographics.
How did they transcend the culture? Like, because that's transcending the CRC culture.
Right. And he basically took the methodology of Willow Creek and practiced it with a fair amount of discipline. And so they had believer service on Wednesday night. They had seeker service on Sunday morning. They met in a warehouse. He's a very competent man. He's very winsome. He's charismatic, but he's also disciplined and can do discipline. So he had exactly the right combinatorial mix to be able to pull off what, again, hardly any Christian Reformed ministers were able to pull off.
So what was he? Was he planning a CRC church?
He did plant a CRC church.
That's not, I mean, did he plant a Willow? What I'm saying is.
Now, and this is what happened. So during that church planting wave, I used to sometimes, when I had a free Sunday, go out and visit successful church plants in the area, all of whom were hiding their denominational names.
Yes.
And I would go in there and I would just kind of, I would look at the table when you come in, and I would listen carefully to the minister, and I would try to figure out what denomination he was actually from or what seminary he went to. And you could almost always do it. Oh, he's Lutheran. He's Southern Baptist. You know, they're EV free, you know, all of the their covenant, all of the usual suspects. And so what happened with Kevin is that he starts using seeker methodology, but of course Bill Hybels was grown up CRC. So that wasn't so then suddenly CRC stuff starts coming in, and he builds a relationship with, you know, a Greek Orthodox father. And then as what happened, all of the church plants that we planted in the 90s and aughts in the Sacramento area, by the time we hit the 20 teens, they were going to every week communion, liturgy that began to look more like Anglican. The music still was contemporary, but it had the ancient modern thing.
Yes.
In other words, all of those churches started leaning liturgical.
I was part of that. I did the same thing.
Exactly.
A decade ago.
And that was happening all around the country. But in the Midwest, we continued to see churches planted with seeker methodology. Almost everyone gave up sort of the Wednesday night believer service and the Sunday morning seeker service. That eventually was abandoned because it just people go to church on Sunday morning. And all of that is to say that the far older depths that the Catholics, the Orthodox, the Magisterial Protestants, the Anabaptists, they would start planting with these new things, but then in order to continue, they had to deep down and reach down and appropriate the older things to keep the thing going and to keep their own souls going.
Yes.
And so it's that interesting dynamic where I think Joseph is exactly right. The Orthodox are going to have Joseph, let me know. I want to use your clip out on the open channel. So, and I'll probably want to use some of this. Is that okay with you, Christian?
Yeah.
Okay. Let me know if it's okay in the comment section, Joseph. Because what happens then is the Orthodox coming to America, probably the outcome is the major outcome isn't necessarily the multiplication of Orthodox churches. It's the influence that Orthodoxy will have on Catholic and Protestant churches in America. And that's already happening.
Yes.
And actually, a lot of what we're doing is doing that.
Yes.
Out into the world.
Not just me, but Jonathan Peugeot. Like, and what's interesting to me about that is this idea of universal history, universal language. Like, and even in my conversation with Hezzy, is like, is there a thread, a language that a new Christian language that we can, or biblical language, Christian, that we can somehow start having productive conversations? Because for me to be able to say, or for it used to be able to say, well, the Baptist Church, quote unquote, doesn't have any sacraments. Well, actually, they do. They just don't call them that.
Right.
And that to me is saying what's going on here psychologically.
Right.
We're treating these things like sacraments, the same thing. So, and that's, anyways, I think that this is an interesting time. And I just wanted to say to Neil, as I move on here, when he was talking about his Neil Daedalus, his project, and what you were talking about, the band Blink 182, you may have heard of them,
yeah.
Punk band from the aughts. They skyrocketed, huge fame, same old story. They blow up and they come back together a few years, a year or two ago. And their first song that they released was a song called "Do I Have to Die to Hear That You Miss Me?" Because what they found, because one of them got cancer and one of them almost died in a plane crash, for them to come back together as a band, it was about love that brought them, their love for each other, and to re-understand what brought them together in the whole first place.
Wow.
And that's what they're operating out of, at least currently right now. And I think that's a great example for, that hits on the personal that we talked about in this space. So
yeah.
Thanks, Paul.
Yeah. That's great. Thank you, Christian. Lance.
Hello, Paul.
How are you?
Members only. Members only.
Members only. Yeah, this is PVK only fans.
Hey, we were talking to Christian, and I know you're lately just kind of thinking about this whole orthodoxy thing and trying to get you wrap your head around it. And you know, one of the things that I've noticed, and I think you're exactly right, because you have to have a priest in order to be able to have an Orthodox parish, right? And priests, much like the same way, it took a long time to produce a CRC pastor. There's a huge investment in that.
Right.
And so, for example, also priests, like when you're a priest, it doesn't necessarily mean that you can hear confession. Like there's this level to where they trust you with that, right?
Yep.
And so to do the thing the way it is, it really can't handle it. One of the things I think it'd be really interesting, so I've gone to a lot of them, but spent my time primarily in a Greek church, and then also visited a lot of the Antiochian churches. The Antiochian churches, when you hear about this explosive growth, it's the Antiochian churches. Oh. Here's what's really, really, so Father Damick is part of an Antiochian church, right? So you've heard that name around, so on and so forth. Father Yosai Trenum is an Antiochian, right? Well, here's what the Antiochians did even way back. They've done their services in English since they've been here. Okay. So they have decades of doing their services in English. Well, what did that produce? That produced English speaking Americans that have decades and decades and decades of connection with respect to that. And so if you're a new convert, it's very easy to get into the Antiochian church because everything's in English, right? So so they have that. Now the Greek church, some Greek churches have gone to mostly English, and those that have gone to mostly English will get, I love my Greek priest and I love my church, and the Greek churches are very small. They are certainly adding people, but the Greek church is the largest by number, but it's the most progressive. And when I tell you that, you know exactly what's going on in the Greek Orthodox Church. The attendance is very low. So for example, my Greek church was like joining a small church. There were 20 diehards who would do everything. And then there was a more of a chunk who would do some things. And then you would have your Holy Week crowd or your Pascha crowd or whatever the cultural things to do, right? And so the Russian church outside of the Orthodox Church, the Russian Orthodox Church outside of Russia also does English too. So again, you start seeing these little bits and then leave these little pieces. And so what you're finding is there is this boom into Orthodoxy, but it's happening primarily in these Antiochian churches.
Interesting.
But you know the reason. I just told you the reason why that is. It's very easy.
But then there's a reason behind why they did that. You know, because and that's where this is going to be so interesting, because I mean the Catholics are this monolith. And so now you've got in some ways market forces between the various branches of Orthodoxy. Which is just super interesting. So
yeah, it's wild. You can go in, like the beautiful thing is no matter where I go, it's the same liturgy as St. John Chrysostom. I can jump into, and I'm a nerd. I go look at all these places, right? I know where I'm at. I can jump in wherever I'm at. Now it's different. Like the food's different at the different places, and there's some different flair and flavor and kind of maybe how they might rhythmically like say it, but the words are there. They're the same.
And that's part of what sort of breeds cynicism among often within Christian communities about Christian culture is you see some of these games being played and it's like, no, maybe you're just kind of playing a game on yourself. You're using all of this Christianese to basically underwrite what you want to do anyway, or what you want to avoid anyway, or And people use this kind of language selectively. And what happens is, again, people watch and get pretty cynical pretty easily because, you know, back in the day when, you know, before we're having the conversation about sex and marriage we're having now, it was always, you know, the gift of singleness, the gift nobody wants. That wasn't popular in college when I was there, those kind of talks. So, yeah, I don't know the degree to which this stuff is necessarily connected, let's say, to formal confessionality or even Christian traditions, as much as it's connected to, like, folk Christian traditions. Because on one hand, I mean, and this gets into, you know, what Pat was talking about, too, in the sense that what I find is most traditions sort of have their the formal tradition, the creeds and confessions and, you know, the leaders and the fathers and what have you. You have the formal tradition, but then you have the layer of folk tradition, mm-hmm. which usually rides on for often the majority of people that they're not educated in the formal tradition. They're not educated at all sometimes. And so there's this other way of life that sort of takes over. And it's usually at those layers that you get this kind of usually sort of shallow, easy to game, easy to deconstruct with cynicism, mm-hmm. these patterns in the church. And ministers have to sort of have an uneasy peace with some of these things, because on one hand, there's sometimes wisdom in folk traditions that are contextualized that the deeper, longer formal traditions aren't as contextualized with. And so you don't want to be too quick to dismiss the folk tradition. On the other hand, you watch some of this nonsense and you just want to start smacking people, because I just really didn't, you know, I'm just, you know, Tim Keller used to point out that, you know, everyone is there very spiritual about God leading them to, you know, their spouse. And why is it God leads them all to the hot girls? You know, you know why is singleness the gift given to the ugly? So, you know, and on the one hand, having a much more, I think, thorough, non-dualistic understanding that the God of redemption is the God of creation, some of those kind of things are a little bit more easily resolved, as you said, to not hyper-spiritualize that, well, this person is dramatically good-looking, and so they will probably have a far easier time finding a spouse. Now, will the marriage go well? Now you're into a whole different other realms. But you're right. But a lot of evangelicalism, because of how evangelicalism formed, you know, a lot of scholars of American church history note that a lot of the major practices of American evangelicalism grew up because the population could grow faster than immigrant churches could deploy churches, because this goes all the way back to Joseph's comments at the beginning. And so what you'll tend to have happen, because people wanted and needed churches out on the frontier, mm-hmm. that's when you get sort of these Bible-only churches, because that's the only thing they had. Mm-hmm. And you get churches with ministers with zero education, because you're looking around the room and you're just going to, and in some ways this is sort of like the New Testament church, you're looking around the room and say, I need someone who is, look at the lists in Timothy and Titus about what Paul says you want as your church leader. A lot of these are shopkeeper things. You want a guy who's going to show up. You want a guy who's not going to get into trouble with sex and booze in the church. You want a guy who's not going to rip people off money. You want someone who's reliable, and that trustworthiness sort of, you know, runs the gamut of human cultures. So what happens in American Christianity is that churches couldn't keep up in many ways with the demand. And so, you know, this guy's been to an Orthodox church one, let him read the liturgy, you know, and this is what happens. And so a folk tradition develops, and the longer that folk tradition develops, the more that folk tradition gets formalized And then the more it gets sort of carried over and becomes a much more rigorous tradition. So, yeah. And but if a little bit better theology, you would say, well, this hyper-spiritualization has really an implicit dualism that can really get Gnostic fast. Mm-hmm. That somehow God hasn't been participating in the formation of any of this, and a more rigorous theological tradition like the Reformed tradition would say the God of redemption is the God of creation. And so it's one seamless package. And then other tensions develop, like nature-grace tensions that tend to develop in the Roman Catholic theological tradition. But it's real. I don't know if that was in any way helpful to you. I just rambled for 10 minutes.
No, I mean, you mentioned the one thing about causing deconstructions later on, because it's not that people are aware that they're participating in folk religion. It's that they think that this is the religion.
Yes.
And that's what they're deconstructing, is the folksiness of it.
Yes.
But they've never tasted the, you know, the deep theological questions. And it's like they come up with a question and they think nobody's asked that question before. And they're the first ones to ask this question. And so they destroyed the whole Christianity because of that one question that was addressed 700-800 years ago.
Yep.
So that happens a lot. But the other thing that happens, of course, is the whole dispensational kind of worldview that says, well, it's all coming to naught anyway, so what does it really matter what I do?
Exactly.
And that's where you don't take the big risks, and because it's all about the end.
Yep.
And that just becomes so central to your focus in your religious life.
And the perpetual challenge of, let's say, the establishment clergy is to figure out how to interact with the folk level. Because you're trying to some way redeem it all the time. The folk level is more powerful than you are. And you have to recognize that people are going to do crazy stuff. They are going to do crazy stuff that made sense to them in the moment. And some of these things, for whatever reason, are going to get mimetic and take off. And so that's more powerful than you. And so, you know, so then what you wind up doing is figuring out how to sort of gently deconstruct some of the folkisms and replace it with something that's actually a lot better founded, a lot more durable, something that's they're really going to be able to live with.
Yeah.
So
you reminded me of growing up in the Middle East. What's really popular is this blue stone. They call it the blue eye, and the hand with the blue eye in it. You know, that's double blessing. I've never heard any clergy person ever messing with that and saying that's just superstitious nonsense. Yeah. They leave that alone, you know.
Yeah.
and mothers insist that their kids have that in their car, you know, hanging for protection and stuff. It just, sometimes you just leave the folk stuff well alone.
It's true.
But what I think, and this may be an overgeneralization, but I'll throw this out there. What I'm noticing is that evangelicalism is really good and powerful at rescuing people from themselves, at saving them from their destructive patterns. But it doesn't seem to be able to develop a strong next generation. Because what's happening is the next generation, because of the generation before they cleaned up their lives, the next generation has it all, let's say, for lack of a better word, cushy. And so they don't really have the same challenge that they need to overcome. And they think, I don't need this anymore, especially because the religion is so based on that idea of salvation as a personal experience, as opposed to the more Catholic and Orthodox of like, we are members of this family, this church family, and we've been since we were born. And we don't have that personal conversion experience.
Yeah.
Evangelicals insist on that.
I think 150 years of Methodism would beg to differ with that. But you're pointing to something that is very true, in that evangelicalism, and this is, so I did my conversation with Redeemed Zoomer this week. And what he is pointing at is basically what you're pointing to too. And this isn't just evangelicalism. Some of this is Anabaptism. And I know they're having some jokes in the live, in the hive mind about why are there's no Amish people in the TLC.
I live in central Pennsylvania. I can represent them if you want.
Okay. But the tradition then becomes the conversion. The conversion becomes the tradition, and exactly. The revivalism becomes the tradition. And whereas, and so I would say that Methodism, for example, has been able to sort of sustain itself in that way, because Methodism sort of created in its tradition this conversionism and revivalism. So that really comes in through Methodism. But now, the thing that I think Redeem Zoomer was pointing out with respect to institutions, they're struggling with being a civilizational religion. Methodists were always nonconformists. And again, in a place like the American frontier, where there are no institutions, there's no government, there's no nothing. You know, think about the Wild West. The institutions are thin. So the church sort of comes in and becomes an institution. And so, and given the fact that who's going out west to sort of take advantage of the Indians and kill buffalo and, you know, do all of this. These are people who are looking for adventure. They're not necessarily allergic to violence. They're looking for opportunities. They're willing to take risks. And a whole bunch of them get in over their head in all kinds of different ways. That kind of conversionist thing that sets up the altar call and the Christian testimony, well, that works, because you got a lot of people who have just destroyed their lives and they're out on the frontier and they're looking, I need something to hold on to. And so, well, here's your 12 steps. You know, this is how you're going to clean up your life. And then, but then they don't baptize their children. And so, and so, you know, we see this in the, you know, the Baptist Reformed but again, going back to my answer to Christian, what tends to happen is there's sort of a you grab what you need at the moment, and so what they needed at the moment was a conversionism and something to really grab. But very quickly, the clergy begin to realize, gosh, I need older, better answers. So that's where, in a sense, the traditions start getting pulled into the vacuum, and certain numbers of people bleed off of the evangelicals and start wandering into some of the magisterial reformed or some of the older traditions, because the shallowness of the tradition, how many times can they play the old song and you just sort of have the dust, you know, the sawdust revival, and, you know, that gets old and you need something deeper that can actually occupy you at a deeper level. So that's sort of the dynamic that happens. And that's where, even though, again, back to Joseph's comment, even though the older traditions struggle with multiplication and deploying, they tend to get somewhere on the back end because they actually do have some riches that others, and you can even look at this at the Protestant Reformation, because on one hand, you can sort of dismiss the Reformation as, you know, this was a folk religion. And there's a fair amount of folk religion going on at that point too. Luther had to deal with it. And so the Protestants sort of go off onto the frontiers. And Protestantism was a religion in many cases that went out onto the frontiers.
Right.
But they also, you know, you look at Luther and Calvin, and they also wanted to say, hey, but we certainly prioritize the scriptures, but there's stuff in the church fathers that you're going to probably want to pay some attention to. And you're going to, because that's where, again, the tradition of the church gets vitally important, because some of these questions have been answered well, and you can find the answers within the traditions. So I think this is a perennial pattern of circulation, and I think it happens both in terms of frontier expansion, but also in terms of contextual change in the world when, I mean, some frontiers are physical, like the Wild West. They're really a civilizational frontier, because one civilization is displacing the other. other frontiers are here in 2024. We are all living in a world that my parents born in the 1930s could never have anticipated. So we're all frontiering now.
Christian universities are frontiers.
I mean, yes.
Campus ministry is a great calling, and it's very much needed because these kids have no biblical foundation of any kind. I mean, yes. They didn't even grow up with the movies.
Right. Right.
You know, so they have no frame of reference. Yeah.
Yeah.
When do we get to do our Bible studies, sir?
I don't know. The thing is, the real sticking point with that is I would need to have the kind of schedule where, you know, I could do this on a very regular basis the same time of the week or month. And that's part of the reason I moved Estuary to Sunday morning, because where am I at night? It's so funny when people call me at 9 o'clock on Sunday morning and it's like, do you really expect me to answer the phone on a Sunday morning? And sometimes these are church people and they're calling me. I'm like, you know exactly where I am and exactly what I'm doing. You know, part of the difficulty is nights of the week. I've already got a Bible study at my church a certain night of the week. Now, if I didn't have that Bible study, I could maybe do one on the internet, but I still do prioritize my local church. So But I really, at the same time, do miss my Sunday school class, because I was able to do things in that Sunday school class that I couldn't. But now, and this is a frontier issue. So at our estuary meeting, I regularly have between 6 and 12 people there at the estuary meeting every Sunday morning, a different mix of people. A good number of them unchurched, a good number of them new to the church, and then some people old to the church. And so I see the important, even though it's not ostensibly catechesis, that group is functioning in a very important formative way for living stones, because this church is sort of on the precipice of no longer being here. And so it does need new people. But the difficulty that you have when you bring in a bunch of new people to an existing thing is the two groups then wind up being parallel. Yeah. And so what Estuary is doing is they're all getting to know each other and they're all getting to like each other. And people who don't come to the service at 11 o'clock come at 9 o'clock. And every now and then they stay. You know, some of these guys are like, you have us in here at 9 o'clock. And you're just banking that some of the times we'll stay. It's like, could happen. Nobody's holding a gun to your head, but you obviously are coming in here with questions about church and Christianity because you're talking about it in the estuary meeting. Whereas I could never get these conversations except with people who are really determined to get in. And to me, it's like, this is just common sense, folks. I mean, I think this is common sense. If you can get one going, if you can actually get a steady stream of unchurched people coming into your church to talk about what's most meaningful to them. But you're exactly right. We are, with every generation, you're on a frontier. And are the more civilizational traditions doing better than the revivalist traditions right now? I don't know. At least the revivalist traditions have a way of that person coming forward and making a big life change. Whereas, and I'm not trying to dismiss my own tradition, because I see it working on both sides of the aisle. And I see it also not working on both sides of the aisle. So this stuff is super complex.
I think the civilizational traditions, a lot of them are ethnically based. And so Sometimes what happens is, It's maintained to a level because of your desire. I mean, you don't want to lose meaning. And so you're, at some point in your life, you become more interested in your ethnic background. Hence the interest in family tree and digging into ancestry and all that stuff. I think that's, it's the ethnic aspect of it that works for the civilizational Christianity, not the fact that it's, you know, the buildings are there, like in Ireland, for instance.
Well, I think part of the difficulty with, I mean, again, apply combinatorial explosiveness to this question, and you'll find, you know, the ethnicity because of culture really helps, because you need a culture. And this, again, is on Luke, I mentioned it with Luke, this Luke's live stream. You need, there are more questions to answer than any of us can cognitively manage. And so this is where a living tradition is really helpful. And this is where new traditions always have to go back and reach back to older traditions, because I thought I was going to start a church, and I see this all the time. I'm going to start a church. And then suddenly we've got young families coming in. And then suddenly it's like, you know what those families you need? Well, you need a nursery, and then you need catechesis. And he's like, well, I just wanted to have music and a sermon and an altar call. It's like, yeah, but if you're successful, you're going to need just about everything else too. And then you're going to need counseling, and then you're going to need this, and then you're going to need that. And you're going to need a parking lot. Then you're going to need a building permit. And then you're going to need a lawyer, and you're going to need an accountant and a bookkeeper. And then you're going to start asking questions. Well, shoot, we're an independent church. Sure would be helpful if we like worked with other churches that had similar answers to these questions. And so then you start a network. It's like, oh, it's kind of a denomination with a different name. I mean, I watch everyone reinventing everything for this very reason. And it's, I try not to be a troll about it. It's just like, yeah, yeah. It was so funny. Myself, Kevin Adams, and I were meeting across the table from a couple of church planters, and they're planting in our denomination. And, you know, we've worked out the funding and the path, and we've recruited them here. We've done all of this legwork so that they could get a good start with this church plant. And Kevin and I are sitting across the table, and we're having our monthly meeting with them, and we're just going around, and one of them says, yeah, we don't really think of ourselves as an institution. We think of ourselves as a movement. Kevin just looks at him and says, does your movement have a budget? So, you know, and it's just kind of the way life is.
The catchphrase I say go to church. What I mean by that is, in some ways, it's you have to engage in the human relationships around you. That's like the best way to go about that. You know, you have relationship, you have a family, you have some kind of community around you. And so that's the best place to go, because in some ways that's the place that will have this procedural aspect to it that will ground the other stuff. You know, it's like if you have to, you know, to help your kids with their homework, or you have to do this kind of really grounded stuff that has nothing, that's very little to do with the ideology, you get engaged in other people's lives, then it binds you in a different way, right? It binds you.
And then, like, my, you know, my father would, he was going to church, and I wasn't really living with him, but he was going to church, and he would, like, kind of, so those are elements of this conversation. Is I gotta go to church.
It's being part of a church is part of Christian discipleship. And in that word discipleship, there's this word discipline, which is, it's a discipline to go to church.
What would be so great about actually going to a church is, like, you start going to a church so that when you do need, like, to be prayed for, when you have something to be prayed for about, you have a place to just say that.
You're dead on right, Grizz, and that is what the church is for. To know and be known, to love and be loved, to have a place to go where people can pray for you, where they will welcome you in. And this is, again, part of why I'm, you know, I want churches to have estuaries, because it is, I know that it is difficult in many churches for people to, in a sense, come in and bring their real self. And what I mean by that is have to say what's on their mind, or you can't wrestle with them. It's like, you know, so Plato, you know, as John reminds us, is broad, so he's a wrestler. You can't wrestle over a screen. So maybe if it's paintball for Jesus, maybe it should be wrestling with Plato. Because, and in church, in a real space, now often it doesn't happen. I understand that, but at least there's a chance to actually have a relationship with grit. And that's part of why churches are local, they're relational, they're face-to-face, they're in real life.
Said about why would young people want to go to church. And I feel like I want to have some kind of dynamic message or something that if they do find some reason to come, you know, I'm trying to fish, so I'm throwing bait and I'm trying to hook somebody. It's what Paul is doing too. It's, he said about being evangelical, evangelism of some sort.
Well, fishers of men is the
yes,
is the promise. Yes,
yes, correct.
It's possessed. We did go to church today. I took communion.
I don't go to church to think or to rationalize God. I go to church to worship Him, right? Yeah. And that's, I'm happy with that. I'm very happy with that. And afterwards, during coffee hour, we can all argue about the God of our understanding, right?
Yeah. But I think you're right. I think that the wild twin, I mean, the thing that led to my sort of dawning to consciousness of Christianity, it was a 101 day vigil that I did in forest, and I went into the forest.
You don't have to go crazy. Yeah. You have to humble yourself and be and do it right here, right now, right?
Get up. I like how Father Spemann talks about it for the life of the world. He says it starts when you get up and get ready. And you walk or you go to church, you start those are simple. I get up, I brush my teeth, I take a shower, mm-hmm. I put on clothes, I go, the things of life, and we're ascending up into heaven. You're